Welcome to another episode of Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy. I'm your host, Cliff Davis. Joining me in the studio today for this episode of The Box Rebellion is Emily Abdow, writer and editor for the NHHC Communications and Outreach Division. We'll be discussing the NHHC monograph she wrote, titled The Box Rebellion, Blue Jackets, Submarines in China, 1900 to 1901. In 2023, Emily presented this monograph at the U.S. Naval Academy McMullen's Naval History Symposium, a world-renowned biennial event that highlights the latest research on naval and maritime history. Congrats, Emily, on the opportunity to present your work, and thanks for joining me today. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having me, Cliff.
For the listeners who may have never heard about the Boxer Rebellion, would you mind telling us a little bit about your background here in NHHC, and what was your motivation to study this very unique period of naval history?
Sure. So I am a writer and editor here at Naval History and Heritage Command. And what that means, very luckily for me, is that I get to do both writing and editing, which is great because I love both, and I love both writing articles and monographs and working on other monographs for our historians. So about half the time I'm editing books from our team of historians here, and the other half the time I'm getting to write. And what drew me specifically to writing about the Boxer Rebellion is actually my favorite fantasy novel series, which is the Poppy War Trilogy by R.F. Kuang. Fantasy is my favorite genre, and because I love history, I love historical fantasy. So this is a fantasy series set in China in the 1900s, and it draws its inspiration from the Sino-Japanese Wars and the Opium Wars. Opium in the book is something that actually gives the characters magic powers. And that really interested me in that period of history in China when Western powers are shipping opium over and China fights these wars to try to prevent the importation of opium, and they ultimately lose. And in the wake of the Opium Wars, they sign treaties with the Western powers that start opening China up to the world and to Western influence, which precipitates a cultural clash. And what happens is the Boxer Rebellion is when this cultural clash sort of reaches a fever pitch. And because I work here and I always have to have that naval history angle, I figured this was a great way to both explore my interest in that time period and bring in the Navy by specifically tracking the role of the U.S. Navy throughout the Boxer Rebellion. And then from a historical significance perspective, once I started learning more, I was even more intrigued because this is the U.S. Navy and U.S. military's first time engaging in coalition warfare on a global stage. So allying with multiple powers as the U.S. starts rising up to great power status. And so because it's the first time out, there are a lot of things that go awry and a lot of lessons learned that we can draw from it. So it makes it a very historically significant time to study.
I thoroughly enjoyed reading your monograph. Right at 100 pages, it was a quick read and very well written in giving the broad overview of what happened from roughly 1840 to the actual rebellion. Would you mind telling us about the unique resources that you used to create this monograph?
So because I work at Naval History and Heritage Command, I have some access to some very unique sources that I think allowed me to contribute to the work that's been done on the Boxer Rebellion by drawing on sources that are not necessarily in every book on the topic. So I began writing the book during the pandemic. So that meant at that time we were mainly all working from home, and I was reliant on a lot of online sources. And luckily our Navy Department library here at Naval History and Heritage Command had digitized a bunch of fantastic firsthand accounts and reports from the Boxer Rebellion. So I was able to do my initial draft, which was an article at the time, using those sources. And then when the command supported me and gave me the opportunity to expand the article into the monograph that we're discussing today, I was able to go to our Naval History and Heritage Command archives and our command library, because at that time we were now in 2022, I could move around a little more, and I was able to check out our proceedings articles. We have a great collection on those, which is where I got some of the maps that are in the monograph that I think really bring it to life. And I actually got my favorite source from our Navy Department library, which is the unpublished memoir of U.S. Navy Captain Bowman McCullough. And he is the captain that is leading the U.S. sailors on the first expedition to relieve the besieged legation quarters during the Boxer Rebellion. And his memoir was a fascinating source, one, because it is this unpublished memoir, so not everyone can necessarily access it, and I could just walk over to our library. And second, Makala, because he writes his memoir so much later, he's very reflective, and he's very open to admitting what he did wrong and what went wrong during the conflict. So that allowed me to add a lot of lessons learned drawing from his perspective.
So you kind of alluded to the wars and the trouble that had been brewing for quite some time with countries like Britain, France, Germany, Russia, Italy, and Japan, and all of them trying to create their own spheres of influence within China, and the people there growing resentful of it. Can you explain what it was that the people were so displeased about and the steps they took?
Sure. So in 1899 into 1900, there are a couple different things going on that really cause a lot of resentment among the Chinese populace. So first of all, in the wake of the Opium Wars, we've got foreigners coming into China, and they're disrupting Chinese society, both at a larger scale and in just the small Chinese villages. So the Westerners are bringing in the technology, like railroads, and those are rendering a lot of Chinese industries obsolete. So the guy who would transport things just pulling his cart is losing his job. So we've got a lot of displaced Chinese workers. The second obstacle for the Chinese is the missionaries. So these missionaries are coming into these Chinese villages, and they are converting Chinese people to Christianity. And when Chinese converts convert to Christianity, they are no longer able to partake in Confucian rites and what would be traditional for them in their villages. So they're very much departing from their cultural norms, and a lot of times they're following these missionaries specifically because they're starving, they don't have resources, they're out of work, and the missionaries offer resources like food. So this causes a lot of resentment in the villages because neighbors look upon those who've converted and accuse them of being rice Christians, this idea they've converted just for food and resources and influence that the missionaries provide, and not necessarily for the faith. What we also have at that time are a lot of natural disasters. So we have the Yellow River flooding, wiping out loads of crop harvest. So you've got a lot of farmers who are displaced and out of work. And then to make matters worse, a drought arrives and stretches on into 1900. And there are some superstitions among the Chinese populace. So they think that perhaps the foreign presence is what is causing these natural disasters. They believe in the principle of feng shui, items being in their place, and they think these foreigners may have disturbed the feng shui of the land. They've built railroads that sort of rattle over the graves of the ancestors. They've built churches that tower over the other buildings in these Chinese villages, and perhaps those church spires have bottled up the sky and prevented rain from falling. So all of those elements lead to a lot of blame on the foreigners, and we have a lot of displaced Chinese people looking for society and organization, and that makes it very easy for a secret society called the Boxers to promote its message, which is support the Qing Empire, exterminate the foreigners, and get these displaced Chinese to join their ranks. So the Boxers wear red sashes, and they practice martial arts they think will make them impervious to bullets, which as a fantasy lover was very cool for me too, because they're essentially kind of fighting with magic, which you don't get to write about very often. So they build their ranks, and since they're trying to rid China of foreign influence, they first start attacking Chinese converts to Christianity. And they're hoping to get them to recant, but these attacks escalate to murder, and they displace tens of thousands of Chinese Christians. They flee their villages. And the foreigners in China aren't super worried at this point because they see it more as a conflict internal to the Chinese. But then these Boxers get more ambitious with their agenda, and they start attacking foreigners in China. So they begin with Christian missionaries. They actually behead a British missionary on New Year's Eve of 1899 as we enter 1900. That's the first recorded missionary attack, but then it expands, and it ultimately expands to such a point that the Boxers are swarming in to Beijing, and they are surrounding the legation quarter. And the legation quarter is the home to the diplomats in Beijing. So it's home to diplomats from 11 different nations, including the United States. And the US minister there, Edwin Conger, is getting very nervous. And he and his fellow ministers from the other countries decide that they would feel more comfortable if they had a guard to defend them. And so Conger and the other ministers put in a call to their navies, and that is where the U.S. Navy shows up on the scene. We have a naval base in Cavite, Philippines, as a result of the Spanish-American War. So the U.S. Navy comes over, Marines disembark, and 56 sailors and Marines travel up to Beijing, and there they form the Legation Guard to protect them as the Boxers are besieging the perimeter.
Now, the Navy had been operating as part of the East India Squadron to safeguard American shipping in the region and Yangtze River as early as the 1840s, right up to the start of the Boxer Rebellion. What were some of the difficulties and hardships that these sailors and Marines endured during that time frame?
Sure. So there are difficulties occurring both inside the legation quarter and outside the legation quarter at this time. So inside the legation quarter, we have these Boxers who are starting to surround the perimeter, and these sailors and Marines are essentially kind of trapped inside and they can't really go anywhere. So in order to be able to survive, they have to raid a bunch of the stores that are in the vicinity and hoard a bunch of foodstuffs. They bring their horses into a certain area to be fattened because, unfortunately, they understand a possibility is they may have to eat some of their horses in order to survive, which does inevitably happen as the summer drags on and they're still trapped inside the legation quarter. And then outside the legation quarter, in early June of 1900, we have the first coalition expedition of the U.S. and seven other countries to try to relieve the legation quarter. And so they set out from Tianjin and they pile onto train cars and they think they're going to be able to just take a peaceful 3-hour train ride to the legations, relieve their compatriots, go home, call it a day. That's not what happens. The Boxers are strategic and they have decimated and torn up the railroad tracks between Tianjin and Beijing. And so at about every few miles, the foreigners have to stop their trains and get out and repair the railroad. And this is absolutely grueling work that these sailors are underprepared for. No American sailors or Marines present, except for one, has experience working on a railroad. And this one guy with experience is the one who ultimately ends up driving the spikes on the railroad because that is a very skilled job. And they end up having to bring in Chinese workers to do this job to speed up the process. So they are slogging through the Chinese countryside in the heat of summer. They barely have water because the Boxers have destroyed a lot of the wells and they're worried perhaps they've poisoned wells too. So it is a very, very uncomfortable time for them. And ultimately this expedition ends up being a failure and they are inches away from all of them being killed because a battle occurs in the Dagu forts off the coast of China between the foreign powers and the Chinese, which causes the Chinese empress to decide that she wants to back the Boxers. And that's when this poor expedition going through China, very underprepared, meets a foe it is not anticipating, which is the Qing Imperial Army. And they ultimately have to retreat. And they go along the High River on their retreat because all the railroads have been decimated.
How was the Battle of the Dagu Forts the tipping point for the multinational coalition force?
Sure. So the Battle of the Dagu Forts is what makes this conflict go from sort of these pesky Boxers harassing both the sailors and Marines inside the legation quarter and the Seymour expedition who's trying to rescue them. And it tips it from sort of unfortunate, a bit annoying, into full-scale war, because the Battle of the Dagu Forts is what angers the Empress Dowager of China, Empress Cixi, and makes her so angry, in fact, that she commits her imperial army to backing the Boxers. So now our sailors and Marines in China aren't just up against the Boxers, they are up against the Qing Imperial Army, which is a modernized force. They've received training from Western powers, including Germany. They have modern rifles for the time, they are well uniformed, they are trained, and they are a much more formidable force than this multinational coalition ever expected to face. And this is one of the reasons that the Seymour expedition has to retreat. Had their enemy just been the Boxers, perhaps they could have made it all the way to Beijing. But because they're now up against this combined force, they know there's no way they can make it through the 30,000 imperial soldiers standing between them and Beijing when they are tired, they are wounded, they are low on supplies and ammunition, and they have to fall back. And this Battle of the Daegu Forts, what happens is these four Daegu forts are guarding the mouth of the Hai River. And this is the river that leads into the interior and leads to Tianjin and almost to Beijing, where there's a lot of foreigners. So the foreign navies who are anchored off of Daegu feel it is important to hold these forts because then they can keep this river open. And it's their line of communication with their besieged compatriots in the interior of China. So the foreign navies come together and they decide we've got to seize these forts, particularly because they're hearing rumors that the Chinese may mine the forts, which would make them inaccessible and would block off the river. So every foreign nation off of Daegu agrees to seize the forts except for the U.S. Navy. At this point, the United States is still trying to hold out and not be pulled into a war. So the U.S. commander actually takes refugees onto his boat and he stations his boat, USS Monocacy, away from the fighting. But during the fighting, while the shells are flying, a shell does actually strike Monocacy, but because of the refugees on board and because of the order not to engage unless directly fired upon, the commander thinks this wasn't really a direct fire, it was probably an accident. And so he steams away from the battle and he doesn't engage. And this is a tipping point because the Navy Department is upset about this. They want to know why a U.S. Navy ship was fired upon without returning fire. They see it as a direct attack. And this is pivotal because it causes the U.S. Navy to decide we're fully in this war now. We are joining with the foreign powers. We are fighting against China. Simultaneously, the Empress Dowager decides, you know, rather than just letting these Boxers harass the foreigners, I'm putting my Imperial Army behind them, because the last time her Daegu forts were seized was during the Second Opium War. And this involved an Anglo-French force going all the way to Beijing. She had to flee her beloved summer palace, and her husband perished outside the Great Wall of China, and she returns without him. So these forts being seized are very symbolic for her and make the decision to commit to war very easy for her.
There's an idiom that says necessity is the mother of invention. What were some of the inventive ways that sailors and Marines used to help in the multiple expeditions and defend the legation quarters?
So my favorite story of necessity being the mother of innovation occurs inside the legation quarter, and it occurs after the Qing Imperial Army has joined the fight and joined the siege of the legation quarter. Because rather than just being harassed by Boxers who set fire to things, who have their spears, now we've got the Qing Imperial Army, and they have their Krupp cannons, they have their sharpshooters with rifles, and they can do a lot of damage to the legation quarter. And the sailors and Marines inside are running low on artillery, but they need artillery to answer the cannons of the Chinese. So Gunner's Mate First Class Joseph Mitchell of the U.S. Navy starts to collaborate with a secretary at the U.S. legation, Herbert Squires, and they start trying to build an improvised cannon. They start trying to use the basis of a pump and make that the basis for their big gun, but in a stroke of luck, there are Chinese refugees who are sheltering inside the legation quarter because the legation quarter has been taking in these Chinese Christians who are being attacked in Beijing, and they stumble upon a junk shop that reportedly has a cannon barrel in it. And this is described as a bronze cannon barrel, and they present it to Mitchell, and this expedites his innovation process because he now has the basis for his gun. He needs a gun carriage, and the Italians had a one-pounder that had run out of its shells, so they take the gun carriage from the one-pounder, and they lash the cannon to the gun carriage with rope. And then the last step was, of course, having something to fire. So the Russians had showed up in Beijing, and they'd forgotten their field piece in Tianjin, and so they just had shells when they arrived. And they didn't want the Chinese to get these shells, so they threw them down a well. But now they haul these shells up, and in order to make them fit inside this narrow cannon barrel, they remove the casings and they pound the shells into the barrel. And a lot of those inside the legation quarter, including Secretary Squires, are a little skeptical of this weapon. They don't necessarily think that it's going to be a very effective response to the Chinese, but in one of the first tests, the gun actually penetrates three walls of the American secretary's house. So he has a semi-unfortunate demonstration of the gun's effectiveness. It does have some drawbacks. It releases a very large puff of smoke every time it fires, which does tip off the Chinese sharpshooters on where to aim their rifles. So its primary gunner, Joseph Mitchell, has to move it around constantly to different points in the legation quarter. He also moves it as sort of a strategy to try to convince the Chinese that the Allies have more artillery in their legation quarter than they do. And it's not super accurate, but it is able to take out Chinese barricades that they're building around the legation corridor at a range of about 30 yards. So I write in the book that it's not a well-oiled machine, but it does get the job done. And in that way, I think it's very symbolic of the collaboration that's happening within the legation quarter, because you have these sailors from different nations. They don't speak the same language. They're collaborating to protect themselves and build barricades, ultimately a lot of times using hand signals because most of these nations don't know English. But at the end of the day, they are able to work together and survive.
Now, how did all these multi-branch, multinational forces actually influence the overall outcome of the rebellion?
So the most influential operation that occurs during the summer is the second expedition to relieve the legation quarter. We have the first expedition, the Seymour Expedition, mainly sailors and marines. They try to take the railroad and they fail. But this second expedition ultimately makes it all the way to Beijing and relieves the legations really just in the nick of time, just when it's looking like they might not be able to hold out any longer. And this second expedition mainly is army. So the army comes in at this point, and particularly in the U.S. forces, it's army soldiers and two battalions of Marines. And they are the ones who get all the way to Beijing, and they've learned some lessons from the first expedition. So rather than take the railroad, they just follow the river because the Boxers can't disrupt that mode of transportation. And rather than the only about 2,000 men the first expedition had, because they really thought they were just facing Boxers, they now know that the Allies have to have a much stronger force. So they have a reported strength of about 20,000 men, and they fight all the way to Beijing. U.S. Army soldiers very famously climbed the walls of Beijing with just using their hands and holes in the wall from where bricks should be. The first one to do it is a bugler. He volunteers, Calvin P. Titus, and he makes it to the top. So in that way, that really is their most influential contribution, is to relieve the legation quarter in the second expedition. But that wouldn't have been possible without the contributions of the U.S. Navy sailors. So at this point in the conflict, the U.S. Navy is playing a logistical role to support the second expedition. So they've captured the Dagu forts, and near where all these Navy ships are anchored, there is a train station that is under the command of Frederick Wise. And he was the captain of USS Monocacy, who steamed away from that earlier battle. And he is now in charge of this train station. He is assisted by liaison officers from each of the nations. So it really is the most effective example of international collaboration in a very organized way at this station, because all of these officers can report to him who he's expecting, what each nation's needs are, and he and his sailors oversee this operation of very rapidly moving 13,000 men, their horses, their big guns, their supplies, all the way to Tianjin, which is a city that they capture in order to do the march on Beijing. And they also move water, which is very necessary because there's no drinkable water on the way. So they fill it in these 5,000-gallon tanks, but then they also put it in tin cans and utensils and really every kind of surface that will hold a bit of water, they put water in. And they maintain this stretch of track between Dagu and Tianjin, which is just this single track that they are able to strategize how to effectively move trains up and down it as in the quickest way possible. And they remodel the train cars too. So these machinist mates and water tenders from Monocacy adapt their skill sets from the ship to the locomotives. They resuscitate the engines of these locomotives and they hack out the insides to be able to fit horses, you know, passengers that the trains aren't necessarily designed to carry. But they do keep one car that is nicer, that they shape up and refurbish really well for the high-ranking officers on their journey. So they aren't riding up with the horses and everyone else. And this effort ultimately is what allows the Allies to take Tianjin and then have all the supplies they need to load onto these Chinese sailing vessels and follow the river to Beijing.
Well, the Boxer Rebellion was a short conflict. There was a total of 59 Medals of Honor issued. 4 for the Army, 22 for the Navy, and 33 for the Marines. In doing your research, did any of these individuals have an interesting story that just really piqued your interest?
Absolutely. This is giving me the chance to tell the story of Dan Daly upon the Tartar Wall. So this is a story that a lot of Marines may already know, and it is a story of this Tartar Wall borders the U.S. Legation Quarter. And guarding this wall was pivotal because if the Chinese sharpshooters were able to gain access to the part of the wall that bordered the Legation Quarter, they would just have direct aim into the quarter. They would be able to make life untenable. They were already able to pick off a lot of people inside, and this would have made it far easier for them. So the U.S. sailors and Marines had to hold the wall, in part because this wall bordered their legation. It bordered the U.S. legation and the German legation. So the U.S. sailors and Marines and Germans were the ones primarily atop the wall. And at one point during the summer, the ministers in the legation quarter tell the Americans that they have to extend the portion of the wall that they're holding. They have to build a barricade farther down the wall because they want to protect the water gate. And the water gate is critical to hold because it is the entrance to the legation quarter that the relief force ultimately uses to come in and relieve everyone there. So Captain Newt Hall of the U.S. Marines and Private Dan Daly walk down this wall to go and scope out the position and make sure that there are not any Chinese soldiers there and that they can build their barricade there. And once they're there, they're waiting for Chinese refugees inside the legation quarter to come up to the wall, bringing the earth bags that they need to build their barricade and the stones that they need. And these earth bags are their kind of innovation, their take on a sandbag. It's just like satin, sackcloth, any material they could find. They were sewn by the women in the legation quarter to kind of take their minds off what would happen if boxers or Chinese soldiers would get in, or at least that was Captain Meyer's idea when he had them do this. So they would stuff it with earth and stone, and that would go on top of the bricks of their barricades. So they're up there on the wall, they're waiting for the Chinese to come with the material, and they're not coming. So Private Newt Hall wants to go back and see what's going on, but he's reluctant to leave Dan Daly alone to defend this position atop the wall. But Dan Daly says, go ahead back, I've got it, I'll defend it on my own. So Newt Hall goes back, he realizes that the delay in the Chinese coming up is they have an interpreter who didn't know English, so they were getting confused with their directions of where along the wall they needed to go. So he resolves that issue, and in the meantime, Dan Daly stays up atop the wall and defends it from the Chinese soldiers who are shooting at him to try to get him to leave, and he holds that position by himself until Newt Hall returns with the Chinese, and they're able to build that barricade for the American sailors and Marines to hunker behind because they spent a lot of the summer just hunkered behind barricades atop the Tartar Wall. So this is a very heroic, brave act, and it inspires Newt Hall to recommend Dan Daly for the Medal of Honor. The interesting thing is, if you look at Dan Daly's Medal of Honor citation, it's actually dated from August when the legation quarter is relieved and not in July when this actually happened. And it has a very vague description about meritorious conduct. But it's speculated by other historians that it likely is this wall action and that was why he received it. And there was just some kind of mix up, or they were just very vague with the citation because there's nothing he would have done then that would have rivaled single-handedly defending the Tartar Wall. And this Medal of Honor for Dan Daly is his first of two. So he is one of two Marines to have two Medals of Honor for separate actions. And another one of those Marines is actually present at the Boxer Rebellion, and that is Smedley Butler. But he doesn't earn a Medal of Honor during this conflict, despite some very brave actions of his own, because at this point in time, officers were not eligible to earn the Medal of Honor. They don't earn that eligibility until 1915.
Of these 59 Medals of Honor given during the Boxer Rebellion, there's one issued posthumously to a Harry Fisher, but that really wasn't his name, was it?
No, his name was Franklin J. Phillips, and he was actually in the Army, but he had deserted because he had come down with malaria. And so he had left because he could no longer fight, but that he was counted as a deserter. But he wanted to serve again, and so what he does is he changes his identity and he signs up for the Marine Corps under an alias, Harry Fisher. and he is killed during the siege of the legation quarter while atop the wall. And he is buried in the Russian legation, which is where a lot of these Marines were buried during the time of the siege. And his mother actually later protests and wants him to be given the Medal of Honor under his real name, but it actually takes a very, very long time for them to be able to correct the Marine Corps role.
So after a period of negotiations between the Allies and Chinese, a treaty known as the Boxer Protocol was signed in September 1901. Can you describe its short and long-term effects?
Sure. So similar to sort of the agreements after the Opium Wars, this protocol was another opportunity for the foreigners to even further open China up to more influence. So navies are now allowed to anchor their ships along the Hai River, and Monocacy actually anchors along that river. And in addition, the Chinese have to burn down the Dagu forts. They have to comply with a two-year weapons ban. A lot of the characters in the Qing imperial court who were pro-Boxer are punished. The Empress Dowager herself gets off pretty scot-free. They sort of craft this alternate history where she was trapped in her palace, you know, against her will, and a lot of the blame goes to these scapegoats. But ultimately, all of these conditions work to weaken the Chinese empire. This Qing empire is the last dynasty in China, and they'd already been in decline, and the empress had very much bucked any Western tradition. She had actually overthrown her nephew before the Boxer Rebellion because he was trying to implement Western reforms. But she flees during the Boxer Rebellion, and when she returns, she concedes that perhaps she does have to yield to this Western influence, and she starts going about trying to implement these reforms. But ultimately, the central government has just been weakened so much, partly due to this Boxer Rebellion and driving the government out. It really is kind of the final nail in the coffin for the Qing Empire. And so then we have the 1911 revolution that rolls around, and the Qing dynasty falls, and we have the Republic of China is born.
Well, a short conflict. What are some of the lessons learned from America's first time conducting coalition warfare?
I think one of the biggest lessons that can be taken away from the Boxer Rebellion is the importance of combating prejudice that you might have for the people you're fighting with accurate intelligence. One of the big mistakes that was made by the U.S. Navy and allies is underestimating the Chinese. So Captain McCullough, in his memoir, he's very reflective, and he admits that he had gone into China with no knowledge that the Qing soldiers had modern rifles. They were well uniformed. They were well organized. And so to not have that knowledge and to think you were fighting against a much more primitive force explains why the Seymour expedition was so unprepared to face their enemy and why they ultimately were almost all killed. So in this case, their primitive view of their enemy nearly resulted in 2,000 casualties. A second lesson is equipping officers with foreign language skills and understanding of their allies. So the U.S. Navy sailors, you know, rather than communicating only with hand signals, it would have been great to have, you know, an officer with the expertise to communicate with the Russians, to communicate with the French. There is actually one point where Tausig is leading a line of sailors, and there are some Frenchmen in the line, and he gets frustrated with them because he's telling them to stop shooting at a certain point, and the British and Americans obey and follow his orders, but the French don't, and he curses them out, but they probably don't even know what he's saying. So language skills would be important, but also at least some officers on hand with an understanding of the other nation's imperial ambitions, because there is a lot of fighting during both expeditions to relieve the legation quarter that's very motivated by each nation having ulterior motives for the claim that they want to stake in China. And some nations have an even more vested interest than others. So Japan is very eager to prove itself. Russia is very eager to prove itself and wield influence. And when you get actually to the day before they relieve the legation quarter, they all agree to go and march at the same time. But the Russians actually attack first. They steal a march and they attack first, and then the Japanese see them doing it and they attack second. So by the time the Americans show up, the battle has already begun. And it's largely because they didn't have a full understanding of the motives that were guiding their allies. A third lesson would just be working with the Allies to establish protocols for coalition warfare so that when it came to organizing the different nations under a structure of command, it wasn't so improvised and so on the fly. So on the first expedition to relieve the legation quarter, the Seymour expedition, there, when they get into these train cars to go through the Chinese countryside, they're much more worried about fighting with each other to see who can get into the first train car, which is an argument that U.S. Navy Captain Bowman McCullough wins. They're much more concerned with that than they are thinking about how they're going to organize themselves to respond to an attack. And it's only after the first Boxer attack on this column of train cars that they realize they need to have a structure of command, not just for each nation, but overall. And that's when they decide, okay, the senior officer in each train car is going to be in charge of all of the sailors and Marines in that car, regardless of nation of origin. But it's not until an attack, which luckily was only 10 Boxers, that they realize this. But had it been a larger attack, had the Boxers approached with their rifles rather than the slow approach they did in their first attack where they were still trying to fight with magic at that point. You know, luckily that was the attack, 10 Boxers making gestures, but it could have been a lot worse had they continued on unprepared as they did.
Right. So are you working on any projects that further study into this period of naval history?
So my next project that I'm currently in the early stages of researching and drafting has to deal with the landing and occupation of Veracruz, Mexico by the U.S. Navy in 1914. So I'm really enjoying it because 1914 is not so far after 1900 when the Boxer Rebellion occurs. And what's very interesting about that is some of the same sailors and Marines that I saw in the Boxer Rebellion, and I sort of feel that I got to know, which sounds a bit strange, but you really do feel like when you're reading someone's personal diary, you're reading their reports, you're seeing their frustrations and their feelings at all of these moments, you get to know them. And so when they show up again in documents and reports for Veracruz, I get very excited. So one of those, I think of them almost as characters because they are the main characters in the stories that I'm telling, and one of those is Smedley Butler, who I said before, he wasn't eligible for a Medal of Honor and the Boxer Rebellion, but for Veracruz, he does end up earning one, and he is a very interesting character there and actually ends up going to Mexico City disguised as a spy. So it's a story I'm very excited to tell, and I'm excited to be writing it.
And for my last question, do you have any final thoughts that you hope the listeners take away from reading your monograph?
So a final thought I would say for both the Boxer Rebellion and now working on Veracruz is the importance of studying these small wars that a lot of our listeners and readers don't necessarily know about. A lot of people, sometimes they've heard of the Boxer Rebellion, but they don't know the ins and outs of it. And with Veracruz, I'm finding a lot of people don't even know it happened at all. And I think what's interesting about these conflicts is they've kind of fallen out of the memory of the American public, but just because we've forgotten about them doesn't mean that the other country involved has. Like we were saying, you know, the Boxer Rebellion was kind of the nail in the coffin for the Qing Empire. It had a big role in shaping the China that we see today. And similarly for Veracruz, in 2014, the 100-year anniversary, that was a big deal in Mexico. So I would just say it's the importance of studying these small wars and remembering that they have lessons learned that are just as valuable for us as bigger conflicts like World War II.
Emily, I want to say thank you for coming in today and discussing the Boxer Rebellion and all that you've done for producing this NHHC monograph. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope others do as well. To quickly recap, more information, stories, photos, and a free copy of this monograph about the Boxer Rebellion, along with resource links, can be found at history.navy.mil and in the podcast show notes. Thank you for joining us today on this episode of The Boxer Rebellion on Anchored in History, Stories of America's Navy.